This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. On March 4th, 1681, King Charles of England signed the Charter of Pennsylvania, officially creating the 12th colony in the New World. It was one of the single largest land grants to an individual, William Penn in this instance, in history, partially to settle a debt owed to Penn's father, but also to extend England's influence in the Americas. William wanted to name the colony New Wales, but the king insisted, and the younger Penn would spend the rest of his life embarrassed that people thought he named the colony after himself. Pennsylvania played a crucial role in the American War for Independence, including playing host to both the First and Second Continental Congress, where the Declaration of Independence was adopted in July of 1776 in the city of Philadelphia. 11 years later, Pennsylvania would be the second state to ratify the new Constitution of the United States of America. Almost a century after that, the state would again play a major role in determining the future of our nation. The Battle of Gettysburg, the bloodiest of the Civil War, was fought on Pennsylvania soil and spanned 3 days that would prove to be a turning point in the conflict that guaranteed the preservation of our Union. And just over 100 years after that, Rocky. That's right, Rocky Balboa, from that same fighting city of Philadelphia, would square off against Apollo Creed for the heavyweight championship of the world, and in the process, win the heart of Adrian, along with the rest of the world. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to Pennsylvania on My Mind. Look, a bunch of other stuff happened along the way, but you get the picture. Pennsylvania produces a sturdy stock, confident, in-your-face, hardworking, what we from the Northeast call good people. Growing up in New Jersey, I was always confused as to why the tri-state area was made up of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Huh? Why Connecticut? Nothing against Connecticut, but they're a New England state. Pennsylvania seems to be a better fit, you know, culturally, geographically, in terms of rivalries and sports. I mean, you name it, cheesesteaks, accents. I don't get it. Plus, it just seems that kids from New York and New Jersey just naturally spend more time in Pennsylvania. It feels more like home. Anyway, Pennsylvania is an interesting state for a number of reasons. Like New York, it's massive for a Northeast state, and it's unique in that its two major cities sit squarely in vastly different geographical regions of the U.S. Philadelphia, the state's largest city, is part of the Holy Trinity of major Northeast cities, along with New York and Boston, while Pittsburgh, the state's second largest city, is on the opposite side, basically in the Midwest, the Great Lakes region, right near Ohio and West Virginia. You might as well be on Mars as Philly when compared to Pittsburgh, at least. And in between, you have forests that go on forever. More than 60% of the state is forested and considered rural. You can go from the hustle and bustle of a major metropolitan area like Philadelphia, and in less than an hour, be in the middle of Amish country. Just watch the Harrison Ford movie, Witness. The Appalachian Mountains run north-south right through the middle of the state, with the lovely Pocono Mountains tucked into the northeast corner. And in the northwest corner of the state is the city of Erie, situated on the south bank of the Great Lake of the same name. But it's the aforementioned Pittsburgh that we'll be focusing on today, because, damn, some weird shit has gone down in Pittsburgh. The Three Rivers area, where the Allegheny and Monongahela Rivers join to form the headwaters of the Ohio River, has long been occupied, going back thousands of years. Now, the first European explorers arrived in the 1660s and established fur trading posts. Then, later in the 1740s, French soldiers from Quebec arrived while trying to find a river route to connect Canada with French Louisiana. Then, in the French and Indian War, that particular piece of land was the epicenter of all the fighting. Then in 1758, General John Forbes was able to take what was called the Forks of the Ohio River and establish a fort there that he named after William Pitt. Fort Pitt would later be named Pittsboro, and then, obviously, Pittsburgh. Following the Revolutionary War, this village, now called Pittsburgh, enjoyed a growth spurt. Due to its abundant local resources and convenient location, the growing town flourished as both a fledgling industrial center as well as a long-term layover base for settlers heading into the Northwest Territory. By 1910, with the American steel industry booming, Pittsburgh had become the nation's eighth largest city, and her mills accounted for half the steel production in the United States. Pittsburgh alone produced more than 95 million tons of steel during the years of World War II. Obviously, a tremendous asset to the war effort, but also led to the worst air pollution in the city's history, with one writer dubbing the city, quote, "hell with the lid off." The national industrial restructuring of the 1980s hit Pittsburgh pretty hard, with massive layoffs across the steel and electronics industries. The city survived by shifting its economic and investment priorities and was able to attract new areas of industry and development along with the workforce to allow those investments to bear fruit. But the city never fully recovered to the point where both the population and economic power could ever rival the industrial era high points. But by then, Pittsburgh had grown to an impressive metropolis, complete with suburbs, a thriving art community, rabid sports fans, and a host of nicknames. The most well-known are the Steel City and the City of Bridges. At last count, there were 446 bridges in the greater Pittsburgh area. Yet for all its rough-and-tumble, working-class attitude, the city is surrounded by tremendous natural beauty that sits just past the outskirts, and there you can find basically untamed, untouched wilderness. The other popular nickname for the city is the Paris of Appalachia. And in one of these remote municipalities to the northwest of Pittsburgh is where our first story begins. But first we have to make a quick stop in Buffalo, New York, in the summer of 1881. At that time, electric street lighting was relatively new and extremely dangerous. There were powerhouses used to generate the necessary voltage, just like there are today, but back then, these structures weren't nearly as secure as they needed to be. A man named George Smith had once felt a strange tingling in his hand as he touched a guardrail in one particular powerhouse, and so a few nights later, he told some of his drinking buddies about it and that he wanted to experience that feeling again. So, heavily intoxicated, Mr. Smith made his way into that unsecured powerhouse, but this time, he grabbed an actual electrical contact as well as the ground wire, thereby completing the circuit and subjecting himself to nearly 6,000 volts of electricity. He died instantly, but curiously, there wasn't a mark on him. And this phenomenon had been observed in several cities where electric lighting was new. Sudden death, preserved body. The coroner of Buffalo brought up the incident with the local scientific society, and it caught the attention of a dentist named Alfred Southwick. Dr. Southwick would go on to invent the electric chair. For years, authorities had been looking for an alternative to death by hanging for the condemned, something more humane, less dramatic. The first execution by electric chair was carried out in 1890 and was very soon common practice across the United States. But then lethal injection was introduced, and the use of the electric chair has seen a massive decline, although it is actually still an authorized method of capital punishment in many states, usually only if the condemned specifically requests it, or if the necessary drugs for lethal injection aren't available. So, for execution by electric chair, the condemned individual is prepared for the execution by having their head and lower legs shaved to ensure proper contact is made with the skin. To further guarantee this, wet sponges are also used between the skin and electrical nodes. A contact is placed on one of the calves of the prisoner, and then a metal helmet with several more points of contact is placed on their head, along with that wet sponge that I mentioned. Then, usually 2,000 volts are sent through the body for roughly 15 seconds. This voltage is enough to cause paralysis in parts of the brain that control the muscles that cause the heart to beat. Cardiac arrest soon follows and the prisoner is pronounced dead. Aside from the heart attack, exposure to that level of voltage for that length of time is also enough to irreversibly damage the internal organs necessary to sustain life. So, 2,000 volts, 15 seconds, and the prisoner is dead, usually with very little external trauma noticeable on the body. Why am I telling you all this? Okay, let's go back to the greater Pittsburgh area and we'll find out. Back in the 1950s, there was a particularly terrifying urban legend in western Pennsylvania that claimed the ghost of a young man, horribly disfigured in an industrial accident, roams the dark country roads and chases off young lovers when they're parked late at night. The story goes that this unfortunate soul, originally thought to be the victim of a lightning strike, was actually killed and nearly exploded by a massive electrical shock. For the few minutes he remained alive after the incident, witnesses claimed that he'd lost his entire face, as well as his left arm, the part on his body where the electricity exited by force. Due to these circumstances, it was claimed that his ghost glowed green. He was dubbed the Green Man, or, more cruelly, Charlie No Face. Now, no doubt, a one-armed, glowing green specter with an exploded face would definitely scare the shit out of you on a backcountry road. But sometimes the truth can be even scarier. Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, although 30 miles away, is officially part of the greater Pittsburgh area. It's a small city of 9,000 residents that sits along the Beaver River, just upstream from where it merges with the Ohio River and disappears. It was on a summer day in 1919 when an 8-year-old boy named Raymond Robinson spied a bird's nest sitting atop a utility pole. As fearless country boys tend to do, young Raymond saw no danger in shimmying up the pole to hopefully snatch that bird's nest and keep it as a souvenir. As he reached out to grab the nest, a part of his body, no one could ever be sure which, came into contact with one of the live electrical wires. For a fraction of a second, Raymond was hit with more than 11,000 volts of electricity, and in a blinding flash, was sent flying off the pole to the ground below. So let's circle back for a minute. We know that 2,000 volts for 15 seconds is enough to kill a grown man. And that's with all the relatively humane protections, clean skin, wet contact to ensure even distribution of the voltage, etc. Raymond was a skinny 8-year-old kid, and his body contacted the live wire in just one spot instead of two. So there was no way to complete the circuit, and that electricity had to find a way out of Ray's body. The path of least resistance turned out to be his face, specifically his eyes, nose, and ears. Basically, his entire face was lost in the accident, as well as his left arm, which is the accepted point of bodily contact, though no one can be definitely sure. But here's the thing. Ray Robinson lived. He obviously had a long and painful recovery, but he recovered. He learned to live with his stunning disabilities during a time in America when services for the disabled were definitely not what they are today. He lived at home or in a place where he could get assistance for the remainder of his life, and he took up leather work, though completely blind, because, you know, his eyes flash boiled and exploded during the accident. Even though completely blind, he learned to make high-quality belts and wallets out of leather that he sold to earn a living. But he also liked taking long walks along desolate country roads in the middle of the night. As spooky as that sounds, it wasn't because he loved scaring the shit out of people. The opposite, in fact. He was fully aware that his appearance was found to be incredibly distressing to many who crossed his path, so he took his walks in the wee hours to avoid as many people as possible. He knew his walking routes well. He could tell by the consistency of the gravel when he was safely away from the main roads, and he counted his steps to know how far he had gone. But his secret soon got out, and the legend of the Green Man was born. People would come from across the Midwest in the hopes of catching a glimpse of the specter, to hopefully see Charlie No Face up close. And many succeeded. Over the years, Ray was known to pose for pictures with teenagers in exchange for beer and cigarettes. A few of the more foolish and evil teens would offer Ray a ride home, only to take him miles in the wrong direction and dumping him out with no way of him knowing where he was. Yes, you're right. Teenagers are the worst among us. But Ray always found his way home because someone would get freaked out and call the police, and the police would always know what was going on and make sure that Ray was safely driven back to familiar territory. Ray Robinson lived until the age of 74, passing away from natural causes in 1985. Although he's gone, his death only caused the legend of the Green Man to grow, with dozens of sightings reported every year of a faceless, glowing apparition walking along a lonely road. Now let's go a bit further back in Pittsburgh history. On May 5th, 1865, a man was arrested in St. Louis, Missouri, on suspicion of being an accomplice to the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. The assassination at Ford's Theater at the hands of the celebrated actor John Wilkes Booth sent shockwaves across the globe and led to an extraordinary government overreach in their attempts to make sure that everyone who was even remotely connected to the murder plot was apprehended and punished. Hundreds of meaningless arrests were made, lives were ruined, reputations destroyed, and one of those was this man from St. Louis. A 32-year-old Irish immigrant named Francis Tumblety. Tumblety would cross the Atlantic on a ship carrying coffins, but he would go on to do great things. He would become a doctor of tremendous renown. But if you looked a little closer, the reasons for his fame were not exactly something to be proud of. He was considered a quack, a snake oil salesman. His medical credentials were never fully authenticated, and he even had a number of deaths attributed to his bottled, quote, cures. The reason for his arrest in 1865? He was supposedly connected professionally to a pharmacist's assistant named David Harold. Harold had only recently been apprehended in Virginia after being on the run for 12 days with John Wilkes Booth, and Harold was very much involved with both the presidential assassination as well as the broader conspiracy to murder other members of Lincoln's cabinet. Harold would be executed along with the other conspirators not long after. But what of Tumblety? Did he know Harold? Yes, they had studied pharmacology together, but then went their separate ways. Was Tumblety a Confederate sympathizer? All indications are no. All he cared about was fame and money. Politics never factored in. After his release and exoneration in the assassination plot, Tumblety settled in Pittsburgh and opened his apothecary, selling elixirs and treating patients. All the while bragging about his wealth, his unmatched medical knowledge, and his curious opinions about women. It's also rumored that Tumblety had been arrested in Pittsburgh for a lewd sex act with a man. Homosexuality was actually illegal then in Pennsylvania, as well as almost every other state. Despite this unfortunate event, Francis Tumblety considered himself a proud son of Pittsburgh and would return often after he moved away. In 1875, after the death of a railway worker who had taken a spoonful of one of Tumblety's tinctures, Tumblety changed his name and moved to New Orleans. There, he was arrested for pickpocketing, and the accidental death of the railway worker came up again, and he faced prosecution. Well, rather than face the music, Tumblety, in 1881, fled to London. While overseas, Tumblety claimed to have cavorted with Charles Dickens, King William of Germany. He even claimed to have been awarded the Legion of Honor, the highest order of merit awarded from the French government. It was also during this time that Tumblety's ferocious misogyny became clear in his lectures and writings. He would draw large crowds due to his eccentric American accent and wildly ostentatious manner of dress. He often wore comically exaggerated military uniforms and grew a mustache more than twice as wide as his face. You should look up pictures of it. It's ridiculous. He was also open about his hatred of sex workers, although he was known to engage in their services quite often. Just not the female ones. By the early 1900s, Tumblety had returned to the States. He lived with a relative for a few years in Baltimore before finally returning to St. Louis, where he would die in May of 1903. So you might be wondering what all the fuss is about with this eccentric charlatan, Francis Tumblety. Well, consider the years he was in England, approximately 1881 to 1888. And right there near the end of his 7 years abroad, just as his hatred for women in general and sex workers in particular was fully blossoming, the Whitechapel murders, five in all, began in the spring of 1888. These exceptionally brutal slayings were committed by none other than Jack the Ripper, an assailant whose identity is unknown to this very day. In fact, very little is known about the killer, but there are many suppositions that can by now be considered factual, especially concerning the killer's obvious medical knowledge. The victims, all sex workers, were hideously carved up with the precision of a surgeon using a high-quality blade. The first victim, Mary Ann Nichols, was found with two deep slashes to her neck, stab wounds to her genitals, and her abdomen was completely ripped open. And the murders grew more violent and grotesque from there. The police were at a complete loss until the arrival of the so-called From Hell letter, a missive to the chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, the people charged with capturing the murderer. The letter, accompanied by half of a preserved human kidney that was removed from one of the victims, was obviously from the killer, and detailed how he fried and ate the other half of the organ, and that he was also considering sending along the knife that he used to do it. Despite this clue, and several eyewitness reports and descriptions of a man seen with the victims, sometimes less than an hour before their bodies were discovered, no arrest was ever made. The killing stopped, and Jack the Ripper became legend. Now, if you've been a fan of true crime for any length of time, then you know it's very unusual for a serial killer to just stop killing. Experts will tell you that they either get arrested on a separate charge and keep their mouth shut, they move away, or they die. So what's the connection here? In November of 1988, Tumblety was again arrested for committing a sex act with a man. He was also aware that due to his outspoken hatred of sex workers, as well as his medical and surgical knowledge, that Scotland Yard considered him a suspect in the Whitechapel murders. So, as he liked to do, He fled, this time to France. He was able to return to America by again using a fake name, and then, as he was only officially charged in the UK with a non-violent sex crime, homosexuality, Scotland Yard was unable to extradite him for further investigation into the Whitechapel murders. So what evidence did they have against him? Several pages of a rambling manifesto that combined his ideas regarding the quackery of his elixirs, along with some sound medical opinions, his feelings towards women, and the superiority of America as compared to Europe, these pages were found in his apartment in London. He left them behind. And they were able to compare his handwriting to the From Hell letter, and it was reported to be a perfect match. The evidence against? You might not believe this, but seriously, the mustache. The enormity of his stash didn't match up with eyewitness accounts of the killer, who was described as having a short, well-groomed mustache. However, years later, an interview with Tumblety was discovered from the summer of 1888, right in the middle of the killing spree. The person conducting the interview began the story with a description of Tumblety, and that description included that Tumblety had a, quote, recently trimmed, well-kept mustache. The Jack the Ripper community of, quote, Ripperologists are split on the viability of Tumblety as a credible suspect in the slayings. But he's as good a suspect as there is. Today there's a store in downtown Pittsburgh called Dr. Tumblety's Time-Inspired Specialty Shop. A Victorian-era store selling elixirs, tinctures, and other locally sourced apothecary products. The next time you're in Pittsburgh, you should stop by and tell them the Green Man sent you. Thanks for listening. Make sure you're following The Devil Within wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. You could also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Until next time, stay safe out there. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Whitkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.